Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenoshans who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. And we welcome you to the Monday morning show on WGTD-HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. We have all been fearful at one point or another in our lives, some of us many times a day. We have all been anxious. We've all been nervous. At some points, we are maybe terrified, not only of a very imminent or tangible threat, but sometimes truly terrified at what might lie down a little further on life's path, the unknown threats to our well-being or the well-being of those we love. At some point, there is a line that is crossed, and such entirely understandable, normal feelings perhaps become something else, something in the realm of what we might consider a disorder or perhaps even a disability. What is it when we come to a state that might properly be referred to as anxiety, an anxiety which becomes something that actually debilitates us? I have in hand an extraordinarily fascinating book called My Age of Anxiety, Fear, Hope, Dread, and the Search for Peace of Mind. It is a book not only about anxiety and our long process of trying to come to grips with it and to better understand it and treat it, but it is also the saga of one man and his own personal struggles with anxiety. I'm referring to the author of the book, Scott Stossel, editor of The Atlantic and author of a previous book called Sarge, The Life and Times of Sergeant Shriver. His fine writing has appeared in all kinds of different places besides The Atlantic, including The New Republic, The New York Times, The Wall Street Journal. But in this book called My Age of Anxiety, Scott Stossel is writing with not only great discernment, with the penetrating inquisitiveness of a great writer and journalist, but also speaking very, very honestly about his own lifelong battles with anxiety. The book is now available in paperback from Vintage Books, a division of Random House, again called My Age of Anxiety. Scott Stossel, we welcome you to the morning show.
Oh, well, thanks so much for having you. Glad to be here.
Very, very glad to be talking with you about this extraordinarily interesting book. I wonder if you could just say a word, first of all, about what it was like to write this book. You do talk about it in at several different points about, as you said, about writing about this in a way that would include plenty of your own personal experience, that you found the undertaking in and of itself to be really quite anxiety generating. Was it so pretty much all the way as you continue to write it? Did the anxiety recede a bit? Or just say a word about the experience of talking about this, and particularly in such a public way.
Sure. Well, it's funny because there were times when I was years late on the book. You know, I originally signed the contract to write it back in 2007. It was due in 2009, and around about 2010, and the publisher is threatening to pull the plug on it. I was very anxious for lots of reasons. And I had toyed the whole time. I knew I wanted to write a book that got into the history and science and culture of anxiety. I'm very interested in the history of psychology. I knew it was a topic that would appeal to a lot of people. But what I wasn't sure, and one dilemma I had was, well, how much of my own anxiety do I put into the book? Do I put any into it? You know, I'm 45 years old now, and I was first diagnosed with anxiety disorders when I was 10, and had been, in fact, struggled with it before that. So, and I had spent most of the previous 30 to 40 years of my life hiding the fact that I had these disorders. If I kept my medication hidden away, if I were going to a therapy appointment, I would make up excuses. And so here I was about to kind of come out. Only my family really knew that I was dealing with this. And the truth is, I don't think, by the end, I was so convinced that the book was never going to come out because I was so late. I'd just be sitting there in room writing, and I'd be thinking, well, no one's going to read this anyway. I need to keep my editor interested. I'll just throw in another embarrassing story about my anxiety, or I'll put in some other embarrassing revelation. I don't think if I was somehow able to convince myself that I was writing it, for an audience of one, and the idea that, colleagues and friends and complete strangers were going to be reading all these confessions of vulnerability and embarrassing situations, I don't think I could have done it. But then finishing the book and having it come out and having the world not end was therapeutic and a big relief for me.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the most important purposes of your book, in a sense, and I don't know how much this was ever on your mind as you began to write it, but I, for one, found it absolutely astonishing that, in a sense, your anxieties, which we'll talk about in a moment, which are many and varied and very acute at times, have not been more crippling to you professionally. Because we get done reading this account of what you have experienced and then look at what you have managed to accomplish despite that. And it's just astonishing to me. I think if we read without knowing to whom this anxiety was occurring, we would assume that we're talking about some poor, pitiable recluse someplace who has no functioning role in society whatsoever, not somebody like you who've achieved great, great excellence in their field despite all this. I wonder if you could just say a word about that mission, in a sense, to let the world know that perhaps all around us, maybe some of the most successful people we know in our lives, might in fact be contending with something as serious as this, and we on the outside might not ever know.
That is absolutely the case. And as you mentioned, I didn't really set out to discover or produce this effect, but it was striking. I have heard from when the hardcover came out last year, I heard from dozens and hundreds of people who are more in the former category you talked about, whose lives are severely constricted and who are debilitated to the point of not being able to work or being on disability by these issues. But I also heard from many, many people in situations like mine, where they are outwardly most of the time very functional, in some cases very successful, in some cases celebrities who you would have heard of, who wrote to say, you kind of nailed exactly what it's like to be in my head. So it is very widespread. I think a lot of people, particular forms of anxiety disorder, in particular like panic disorder, for whatever reason, there's a lot of evidence that people who have that are very good at hiding it. And they tend to be high functioning. They tend to be sort of perfectionists, and they may be miserable inside, and they may at times be debilitated, but they're able to cover it up and to be fully functioning. One of my colleagues the other day just said, he said, one of your, because my colleagues here at the Atlantic magazine where I work, a lot of them were surprised when they read the book and saw, how much I struggle with this. And one of my colleagues the other day said, one of your superpowers is hiding your anxiety. And the thing is, I am mostly able to project an aura of kind of competence and confidence, which sometimes I actually feel. There are many times, and I think this is true of many people, where that outward front of competence and confidence is at odds with kind of internal churning and terror. And there are other times when I can't even project that outward confidence if I'm in the throes of a panic attack or melting down. And then you just have to be good at sort of melting away and sort of licking your wounds until you feel well enough to move on again.
I especially appreciated that at one point, I believe it's actually in a footnote, you make mention of a couple of NFL luminaries who have suffered from this to a very serious extent, one of them being the affable former Pittsburgh Steelers quarterback Terry Bradshaw. And I was especially glad you mentioned him, along with running back Earl Campbell, I think. But I thought Terry Bradshaw was so good that you mentioned him specifically, because his outward appearance and demeanor is exactly contrary to what we might imagine in terms of somebody who suffers from some kind of really serious anxiety disorder. I think a lot of us know people that we might sort of think of as nervous Nellies or sort of shy, hesitant, jumpy people, and we might immediately think maybe underneath there's an anxiety disorder there, and others for whom the outward personality would have us never even consider the possibility that underneath that cheerful surface might be something else, like a serious anxiety disorder.
Well, exactly. And one reason that I wanted to highlight the Terry Bradshaws and the Earl Campbells of the world, both of whom have talked about this publicly, both of them were at various times more or less incapacitated and housebound by anxiety and panic attacks. And it's, I think particularly for men, there's the sense that you can't. It's showing weakness or vulnerability or lack of bravery is unmanly or particularly shameful. And I think this is a widely shared cultural value and something that I had to struggle with myself. And you look at Earl Campbell or you look at Terry Bradshaw. Terry Bradshaw's won 4 Super Bowl rings. Earl Campbell is a big, bruising, tough as they come running back. And the notion that they can suffer it means that none of us are necessarily. Don't assume that anyone is immune to sort of the ravages of what various forms of mental illness can do. And don't, as you say, with Bradshaw, necessarily be distracted by the outward veneer of kind of good cheer and complete calm that Bradshaw is now able to project most of the time. But he's talked freely and in fact has been a spokesperson for various antidepressant medications that helped him with his panic disorder. Hmm.
We're speaking with Scott Stossel, and we are talking about his marvelous national bestseller, now available in paperback, called My Age of Anxiety: Fear, Hope, Dread, and the Search for Peace of Mind. I think at this point it's appropriate for us to talk about the sort of the scope and breadth and depth of the issues with which you have struggled for so much of your life. I think earlier I said your lifelong struggles with anxiety, and that's, I presume, not literally true. But at what age did anxiety first begin to reveal itself in your life? I mean, can you remember that the earliest manifestations of undue anxiety in your life?
Yeah, I mean, and I actually don't think lifelong is unfair. I mean, from a very young age, even before I remember, before I have conscious memories of, my parents talk about me as having, acute separation anxiety. And then I remember that as a little kid, not wanting to go to school. I would get dropped off at soccer practice and would end up, or baseball practice, and would just cry on the sidelines the whole time because I just wanted to go home. Now, separation anxiety in little kids is a normal developmental stage, but for me, it kind of, and this is where I started to become consciously aware of it, as I got into elementary school and was still having these, I would be convinced anytime my parents were 2 minutes late coming home to relieve the babysitter, I literally wore grooves in the rug in my childhood bedroom because I would spend every night pacing around convinced that they died in a car crash, and utterly convinced. And that was sort of, this is before I was diagnosed with anything, and this, when I'm 6, 7, 8 years old. And I think that was probably early evidence that I had a kind of nervous disposition and a propensity to develop anxiety. And then when I got older, I developed the first and still most longstanding and acute of my phobias, which is, will sound peculiar to people who don't have it, but to those who do, and there are a surprising number, emetophobia, which is the pathological fear of vomiting. And being averse to vomiting is a normal thing. Most people are, but for me, starting when I was about 7 years old, I lived in daily terror of catching a virus or getting food poisoning, and became kind of a compulsive hand washer because of this. And it started to affect the quality of my life so much that it became evident to my parents. And finally, when I was about 10 years old, they took me to a local psychiatric hospital just to get evaluated. And sure enough, I was diagnosed with a bunch of kind of childhood versions of anxiety disorders. And then from there, when I got into high school, I started developing my sort of public speaking phobia. I can remember vividly being in seventh grade and having to give a science report. And I stood up in front of the class and my head started swimming and I started feeling nauseous and I told the teacher I had to sit down. And he sent me back to my chair, and it was just mortifying, because at that age, it's hard enough being in middle school, but when everyone's laughing at you because you've just turned bright red and started sweating. So that was kind of the beginning of that particular phobia. And then as I got into, teenage years in college, I started developing panic attacks. Sometimes that would come out of nowhere. Sometimes that would be triggered by some, what they call phobic stimulus. And along the way developed, a whole collection of other ones like, that are fairly common, fear of heights, fear of enclosed spaces. All of those get combined with fear of flying. And then I have a kind of peculiar aversion slash phobia called turophobia, which is aversion to cheese, which I developed when I was about 5 years old. Yes, I have a broad array of fears and phobias, but they're, and again, I know this both from reading the statistics, but also from hearing people respond to the book. Thousands of people have come to say, you know, I thought I was the only one like this who had this or that phobia or this collection of fears, but many, many people do.
Mm. I want to briefly break away from this interview with Scott Stossel in order to read for you an excerpt from his book, My Age of Anxiety, Fear, Hope, Dread, and the Search for Peace of Mind. The book opens with a chapter called The Nature of Anxiety, and right at the start of it, he gives a harrowing account of the terrible panic attack which he suffered on his wedding day, in fact, during the processional of his wedding, as his bride was walking down the aisle toward him. I think by reading this detailed account of that moment in Scott Stossel's life, you get a very good sense of just how debilitating and serious his anxiety issues were and to some extent continue to be. Again, this is from the very opening of his book, My Age of Anxiety. These are the words of the author, Scott Stossel. I have an unfortunate tendency to falter at crucial moments. For instance, standing at the altar in a church in Vermont, waiting for my wife-to-be to come down the aisle to marry me, I start to feel horribly ill. Not just vaguely queasy, but severely nauseated and shaky, and most of all, sweaty. The church is hot that day. It's early July, and many people are perspiring in their summer suits and sundresses. But not like I am. As the processional plays, sweat begins to bead on my forehead and above my upper lip. In wedding photos, you can see me standing tensely at the altar, a grim half-smile on my face as I watch my fiancé come down the aisle on the arm of her father. In the photos, Susanna is glowing. I am glistening. By the time she joins me in the front of the church, rivulets of sweat are running into my eyes and dripping down my collar. We turn to face the minister. Behind him are the friends we have asked to give readings, and I see them looking at me with manifest concern. What's wrong with him? I imagine they are thinking. Is he going to pass out? Merely imagining these thoughts makes me sweat even more. My best man, standing a few feet behind me, taps me on the shoulder and hands me a tissue to mop my brow. My friend Kathy, sitting many rows back in the church, will tell me later that she had a strong urge to bring me a glass of water. It looked, she said, as if I had just run a marathon. The wedding reader's facial expressions have gone from registering mild concern to what appears to me to be unconcealed horror. Is he going to die? I begin to wonder that myself, for I have started to shake. I don't mean slight trembling, the sort of subtle tremor that would be evident only if I were holding a piece of paper. I feel like I'm on the verge of convulsing. I am concentrating on keeping my legs from flying out from under me like an epileptic's, and I'm hoping that my pants are baggy enough to keep the trembling from being too visible. I'm now leaning on my almost wife. There is no hiding the trembling from her, and she is doing her best to hold me up. The minister is droning on. I have no idea what he's saying. I am not, as they say, present in the moment. I'm praying for him to hurry up so I can escape this torment. He pauses and looks down at my betrothed and me. Seeing me, the sheen of flop sweat, the panic in my eyes, he is alarmed. Are you okay? He mouths silently. Helplessly, I nod that I am. Because what would I do if I said that I wasn't? Clear the church? The mortification would be unbearable. As the minister resumes his sermon, here are three things I am actively fighting: the shaking of my limbs, the urge to vomit, and unconsciousness. And this is what I am thinking: get me out of here. Why? Because there are nearly 300 people, friends and family and colleagues, watching us get married, and I am about to collapse. I have lost control of my body. This is supposed to be one of the happiest, most significant moments of my life, and I am miserable. I worry I will not survive. As I sweat and swoon and shake, struggling to carry out the wedding ritual, saying I do, putting the rings on, kissing the bride, I am worrying wretchedly about what everyone, my wife's parents, her friends, my colleagues, must be thinking as they look at me. Is he having second thoughts about getting married? Is this evidence of his essential weakness, his cowardice, his spousal unsuitability? Any doubt that any friend of my wife's had, I fear, is being confirmed. I knew it, I imagine those friends thinking. This proves he's not worthy of marrying her. I look as though I've taken a shower with my clothes on. My sweat glands, my physical frailty, my weak moral fiber have been exposed to the world. The unworthiness of my very existence has been revealed. Mercifully, the ceremony ends. Drenched in sweat, I walk down the aisle, clinging gratefully to my new wife. And when we get outside the church, the acute physical symptoms recede. I'm not going to have convulsions. I'm not going to pass out. But as I stand in the reception line and then drink and dance at the reception, I'm pantomiming happiness. I'm smiling for the cameras, shaking hands, and wanting to die. And why not? I have failed at one of the most elemental of male jobs, getting married. How have I managed to cock this up, too? For the next 72 hours, I endure a brutal, self-lacerating despair. My wedding was not the first time I'd broken down, nor was it the last. At the birth of our first child, the nurses had to briefly stop ministering to my wife, who was in the throes of labor, to attend to me as I turned pale and keeled over. I've frozen mortifyingly on stage at public lectures and presentations, and on several occasions I have been compelled to run off stage. I've abandoned dates, walked out on exams, and had breakdowns during job interviews on plane flights, train trips, and car rides, and simply walking down the street. On ordinary days, doing ordinary things, reading a book, lying in bed, talking on the phone, sitting in a meeting, playing tennis, I have thousands of times been stricken by a pervasive sense of existential dread and been beset by nausea, vertigo, shaking, and a panoply of other physical symptoms. In these instances, I have sometimes been convinced that death or something somehow worse was imminent. Even when not actively afflicted by such acute episodes, I am buffeted by worry about my health and my family's members' health, about finances, about work, about the rattle in my car and the dripping in my basement, about the encroachment of old age and the inevitability of death, about everything and nothing. Sometimes this worry gets transmuted into low-grade physical discomfort, stomach aches, headaches, dizziness, pains in my arms and legs, or a general malaise, as though I have mononucleosis or the flu. At various times, I have developed anxiety-induced difficulties breathing, swallowing, even walking. These difficulties then become obsessions, consuming all of my thinking. I also suffer from a number of specific fears and phobias. In short, I have, since the age of about 2, been a twitchy bundle of phobias, fears, and neuroses. An excerpt from Scott Stossel's book, My Age of Anxiety. I'm especially curious about what it was like, you've touched on it already, what it was like to be, for instance, a child in elementary school versus a child in middle school versus a young adult in high school, mm-hmm. How you were perceived both by teachers and by your fellow students. And how dramatically did that change? I mean, were there various chapters in what I've just framed in which you felt, you know, like more of an outsider or more ostracized or more odd? Were there other chapters where you didn't feel that quite so acutely? I'm just curious about that particular phase of your life's journey and what this felt like. I guess I'm asking, when was it hardest? When was it easiest?
No, very good question. And actually, a very specific answer to that. It was worst in seventh grade when I was 12 years old. But before that, I mean, I think, you know, I started to have these issues when I was younger in elementary school, and I would wrestle with them and you know, have, if someone in my family got sick, I'd spend the next 72 hours literally counting off the hours, worried that I was going to be sick, obsessively washing my hands. But it didn't, I think, for the most part, nobody would have thought there was anything I was a little shy, but I was a good athlete. I did well in school. I don't think that teachers or peers would have said there's anything wrong with Scott. Then in seventh grade, I went to a new school, and that's when everything kind of fell apart for me. And around about January of that year, I can remember this, very, very vividly. Throughout the fall, it had become harder and harder for me to be able to go to school in the morning. I would scream and cry, and my parents would literally have to physically, pry me from my bed, physically dress me, frog marched me out to the car, and then, but I managed, all through the fall to get through that. Again, I think probably, I actually don't know what my peers thought at that point, but in January of that year, I sort of broke down, and I remember hearing about an outbreak of a stomach virus, just sitting there at lunch, hearing a couple of teachers talk. And that night I went home and just fell apart. Literally, I have this vivid recollection that I talk about in the book of, just lying on the floor of the living room at home, sort of screaming and crying and saying, I can't take it. I'm so anxious. And that was the point at which my parents, and I was already in seeing a psychiatrist at that point, but then they called the, there was a question of, did I need to go to the ER? But they got me on a bunch of anti-anxiety medications, and I sort of limped my way through the rest of seventh grade. And I think, and again, who knows, this is imprinted in my own mind as being this searing, shameful thing. I believe that people thought I was weird. I could no longer interact socially with people. I would stop going to friends' houses. I'd spend most of the time just sort of sitting quietly in a corner, being emaciatedly thin because I was too nervous to eat, and I would fidget constantly. That was the nadir, and getting through that year, what was probably one of the toughest things I've had to do in my life. But by eighth grade, I was a little bit better. I was able to, taper off some of the medications in eighth and ninth grade. And I remember actually in ninth grade, I won some award in school, which in retrospect, it was some really vague thing for consistent cheerfulness and positive growth. And I think what they meant was it was the teachers being nice and saying, okay, he's finally back in the land of the living again.
Right. Wow. You mentioned the fact that you were a talented athlete. I was especially curious to know, unlike those very, for instance, earliest experiences in maybe Little League or something, as you kind of recounted, kind of sitting on the bench and crying, but it sounds like at some point you were able to at least escape the debilitation to some extent and function at least pretty successfully. To what extent was that a helpful, healthy outlet for you? And did you have other outlets as well that made a positive difference in battling this?
I mean, as a kid, it was helpful to be, and this is to anyone who has kids who have issues like these, it is important to seek professional help because nowadays, the sort of cutting edge recommendation of choice is cognitive behavioral therapy, which can be fairly short course and can, in a very brief period of time, give a kid someone to talk to and give them skills and ways of changing their thought patterns. And I wish I'd kind of had, I did have a therapist, but he wasn't using cognitive behavioral therapy techniques. For me, ironically, sports, I've always loved sports. I played lots of them as a kid, and I was reasonably talented athlete, but it actually went from being an outlet to being another source of great anxiety because as I got into high school, I played tennis, for instance, and I was on the tennis team, and in every match, partway through, I would get overwhelmed by terrible anxiety that had to do with fear of losing, but then I'd get a stomach ache, and then I'd get nervous about my stomach hurting, and then that would make me more nervous, and then my stomach would hurt worse, and after a while, I'm not even paying attention to the tennis match anymore. I'm just trying to get off the court, so I'm starting to lose intentionally. So the irony is actually there have been periods where athletics were sort of, rather than being a productive outlet, they were kind of a major contributor to my anxiety. That said, I will say that in adulthood, and again, having read extensively in the literature, regular exercise is one of the best sources of, treatment and of anxiety and resilience against it. These are all the things that your mother and grandmother tell you, get enough sleep and get regular exercise. That's true for your physical health, but it's also very, very true for your emotional health. And there's now, I can speak from personal experience that that's the case, but also there's ample cutting-edge research data to support that. Mm.
Your book also includes, at certain points, accounts of what your parents did about this, and, of course, also to some extent, we really get an account of what you felt they were doing on behalf of these issues, particularly towards the end of the book in a chapter called Nurture versus Nature, when you talk about a very interesting vacation and a diary that is probably very difficult, I should think, for you to, in a sense, reread or relive. But it also prompted a very interesting comment from your own mother that I think would be interesting to have you share it with our listener, if you don't mind.
Sure. Well, in that chapter, I talk a lot about the sort of nature versus nurture, as you say, or genes versus environment. And, the reality is that the causes of anxiety are sort of multifactorial. And actually, I end up concluding by the end of that chapter, because I talk about my great-grandfather who spent years in and out of psychiatric institutions. He also was a very successful, he was the dean of Harvard College for a while, but ended up having to spend large parts of the kind of final 30 years of his life in and out of psychiatric institutions for his acute anxiety, and eventually getting electroshock therapy. So the debate I'm kind of wrestling with in this chapter is, to what extent is my anxiety a product of genes that I was born with versus, say, the way that my parents raised me? And I go deeply into the literature called attachment theory, which has theory about, how your primary caregiver treats you as a young child has powerful effects lasting decades about how you kind of relate to the world and how secure and comfortable you are. So, a couple of things you referred to there. I actually, for this book, went back and interviewed my therapist from when I was 10 years old. I was going back to see him after many years, and I asked him, I said, what do you think is the cause of my anxiety? Is it genes? Is it environment? Was it my parenting? And he said something which I knew was the case from reading around the books, that you had a particularly bad parenting diet, as they say, and that I had a very, very overprotective, anxious mother and a kind of distant father, which is quite common. And I should say, too, that I actually have good relationships with both my parents now. They both, particularly my mother at the time, was doing this. All of this overprotectiveness was, I think, motivated by love and concern and her own anxiety. But she sort of offered overprotection, but, and this may be the quote that you're referring to, she actually says she consciously withheld affection because she had grown up feeling very loved and coddled by her mother and felt that, but also grew up, my mother did, to suffer from panic attacks and some of the same anxieties that I do. And she thought that by withholding affection, she was actually going to be helping me out. But as it turns out, that's a very bad combination, overprotection and lack of affection. And then with my father, the diary entry you mentioned, he very kindly shared this with me, and it was sort of painful to read at the time, although it's actually led to my father and I developing a much stronger and better relationship in adulthood. But he sort of didn't know how to relate to my anxiety, and so I would be, all the way into my teenage years, I'd be screaming and crying at night because I was so overwhelmed with anxiety and couldn't sleep. And I'm much more sympathetic to this now, being a parent myself. Sleep deprivation can do horrible. But he would come into my room and sometimes get physically abusive with me, just out of sheer frustration, which of course made young me feel, as awful and lonely and terrible as possible. So obviously, I think these were contributing factors to my anxiety, at the time and as an adult. However, I think that the greater contributor by far is sort of the constellation of genes that you inherit. Although I also want to say, back on the other hand again, that, and I wrestle with this a lot in the book, you never want to say that genes or biology are entirely destiny. You can always overcome them. You can develop resilience even in the face of, having been born with anxious tending genes or having been subjected to trauma, much more major than I was. Plenty of people suffer major, major trauma that leads to lifelong anxiety disorders. You can overcome that, and researchers are learning more about how to do that.
We're speaking with Scott Stossel about his book, My Age of Anxiety, Fear, Hope, Dread, and the Search for Peace of Mind. Much of your book wrestles with something that I touched on in the introduction, namely that we all feel fear at points in our lives, and it would be bad, it would be detrimental to our well-being if we didn't. I mean, fear plays a very important function, but there is some point when it becomes something else that is more unhealthy than healthy. I appreciate the fact that that your book wrestles with this as much as it does, in a sense, really offering no overly tidy answers or tidy definitions. I think one of the most effective ways in which you kind of explore this complexity is the start of one of the chapters where you outline three different instances of treatment being sought. In one case, it wasn't for you. I forget if it was your father or your grandfather.
It was my great-grandfather, that's right.
Your great-grandfather. And then two instances in your own life. And I don't remember, but those various moments. Oh, yeah, here we go. 1948, 1979, 2004. So 31 years between the first two, 25 years between the second two. And it's fascinating to hear the differences in terminology proffered by the experts in those various encounters or transactions, if you will. Tell us a little more about what you think this tells us about the complexity of some of these questions.
Well, you're absolutely right. There's no tidy answers, at least not yet, and I suspect we'll probably never have completely tidy answers to what is the distinction between, you know, anxiety on a spectrum, you know, even somewhat intense anxiety sometimes as a normal human trait versus anxiety as a clinical or pathological condition. And, you know, unlike with, say, if I break my ankle and you look at my foot in an x-ray, you can say that is objectively broken. We can treat it. That is a medical condition called a broken ankle. Whereas if you know, they now have all kinds of technologies, FM, you know, functional magnetic resonance imaging, where you can, you know, put someone in a MRI machine and show them scary images and see how their brain lights up, and you can take people who are self-described as anxious and people who are self-described as non-anxious and compare how their brains react. And you do see tangible differences in the brain function of the non-anxious versus the anxious and the anxious reacting brain versus the calm brain. But that said, it's not uniform, and it's not nearly as straightforward as that thing is broken or it's not, because there are some people who will tell you, truthfully, they are not feeling anxious, in that if you look at their brain in a brain scanner, their brain is reacting the way an anxious brain is reacting. So are they, you know, it's showing the equivalent of a broken ankle of the brain, except they're experiencing no symptoms. So what's the diagnosis then? And there's been, you know, as you alluded, you know, my own view after spending many, many years working on this and living through this, you know, there is clearly for people, not just with anxiety, but depression and bipolar disorder and other things, you know, many people suffer from, you know, genuine distress that is real and that is treatable and that, you know, probably should be considered medically. But there are plenty of people who are, you know, what they used to call the worried well, who, you know, life is stressful. There's a lot of evidence that culture as it exists today is structured to make us more anxious. So where's the line? And the fact that the definitions keep changing, I mean, so the you know, the 1948 diagnoses versus the 1979 ones versus the 2004 ones, you could argue that the same underlying condition was being diagnosed in every single instance. Twice it was myself, once it was my great-grandfather, but each time we got a different name or a different set of names for what ailed us, which suggests that, you know, there's a cultural element to this and kind of a political element to, you know, because every time the definition changes for different disorder, you know, different subspecialties of medicine gain or lose, and in particular the pharmaceutical industry, if they can enlarge the diagnostic net so that more people are diagnosed with social anxiety disorder or generalized anxiety disorder, that's more people they can prescribe to. Now, again, I say this is another area where things are not tidier with medication. I have relied intermittently heavily and constantly non-heavily on medication for 30-plus years. And yet I still have a sort of complex relationship with the idea of medication, because I think there are a lot of people who get medicated who don't necessarily need to be. It's just easier for somebody. The insurance companies reimburse doctors the same amount for a 15-minute psychopharmacology consult as they do for a full, what they call, 50-minute psychotherapeutic hour. So it's more efficient for the doctor to just give out drugs. So I think there are probably a lot of people who are getting medicated for these conditions that don't need it. At the same time, I think there are a lot of people who don't have access to the mental health care system, who are poor or just not plugged in or are not aware that what they're suffering from his real medical condition aren't aware that they can find help in forms of various psychotherapy or medication.
Mm. I was surprised that it, in the many quotations that are from the book of past writers and sometimes self-proclaimed experts, I mean, and some names we recognize like Sigmund Freud and Søren Kierkegaard and so on, and then other names probably not nearly as familiar. But one of the things I thought was striking was it appeared, and you always are careful to include the date of these various quotations from whatever books or journals or whatever they might be, but I was kind of surprised at how perceptively anxiety has been understood. When you sometimes think about the way centuries ago physical maladies were very much misunderstood, and of course plenty of mental and emotional ones as well, where it was mistaken for demon possession or whatever. But on the other hand, I was impressed by the consistently high quality of many of the quotations that you shared with us, even those from maybe a century or two ago. Not that they had all the answers, or maybe. But I was impressed that this has been given such careful thought for such a long time. I don't know that I'm making that point very well, but do you know what I'm saying?
Well, definitely. What I took away from that, I mean, and I found this weirdly consoling, was that it's not just from a couple centuries ago, but literally 2,000 years ago. I mean, I was finding quotes from, you know, Hippocrates in the 4th century B.C. in ancient Greece, or the ancient Roman physician Galen in the 2nd century A.D., or Renaissance physicians, or doctors in England during the Enlightenment. And they are all, you know, they sometimes use slightly different terms. They don't call it anxiety disorders. They're not calling it depression. They might call it hysteria or melancholia or neurasthenia or something. But what you find is that this is a element of the human condition that is clearly built deeply in and goes back, as I say, millennia. And so when Hippocrates, you know, the ancient Greek physician, he describes people who would today very easily fit under the modern American Psychiatric Association definitions for, say, panic disorder or a fear of heights. I mean, it's really astonishing, these clinical case studies. So there's something actually consoling about the fact that, you know, these people 2,000 years ago were suffering from the same things that we do now. And also, I thought where you were maybe going with this, you know, what was fascinating to me too to discover, and I sort of knew this before I began research but didn't realize it fully until I delved deeply into it, how many of the major sort of fathers of our understanding of the modern psychology and the modern mind, Darwin, Freud, William James, and a lot of lesser-known figures, themselves suffered cripplingly from mental illnesses of various kinds and anxiety in particular. You know, Charles Darwin had a terrible anxiety and was basically housebound for the entire decades that he was working on the Origin of Species. And this made me feel, so this gets back to what you were talking about at the outset. You know, Darwin we think of as this giant. He was. Freud, too. And yet you read their letters or you read their diaries or you read biographies about them, and they were riven by self-doubt, and Darwin was housebound by this, you know, the horrible array of nervous symptoms. Freud, too. William James had horrible panic attacks. And I found this, you know, very, very consoling.
Mm. I know that our time is very limited, but I think I would really be remiss if I didn't give you an opportunity to just say a word about the extraordinary woman to which you are married. The book begins with this harrowing account of a terrible anxiety attack which you suffered as your bride walked down the aisle towards you up at the front of the church. But your marriage has resulted in two lovely children and a lovely life together. Can you just say a word about what kind of difference she has made? Because I think we may not only have listeners out there who themselves suffer from anxiety, but we might have spouses listening as well, wondering what they can do on behalf of someone they love. What has your wife done for you?
Well, I mean, she, you know, without her, not only would the book not have been written, nor the previous book, but, you know, who knows, I might be one of those people who, you know, has not left his house for a decade. She does not suffer from clinical anxiety, thank goodness. And, you know, she has learned over the years the right mixture of sympathy and empathy when I'm, you know, in the throes of a panic attack, and but also a kind of kick in the pants, like, you know, get over yourself. This is not a big deal. You need to deal with the things we need to deal with. she learned pretty early on. You know, we'd been dating for a few months, and I planned what I hoped was going to be sort of a romantic trip to England. But of course, I have terrible flying anxiety, and I had told her a little bit about my struggles with anxiety, but she had never seen it manifested. So we are getting on board, you know, an overnight flight from Boston to London. This was back in the late 90s, and we get on the plane, and I think, you know, I could see her eyes widening as I'm sitting there kind of melting down on the plane. So the good thing about that was that she didn't run fleeing for the hills as she probably should have. You know, she knew at that point what she was getting into. And then at the wedding, I felt horrible afterwards. I felt like I'd ruined the whole thing, although I partly blame her because she told me she didn't want me to be medicated for it, for this, you know, most important experience of our lives. So I didn't. And then, you know, she saw what happened to me, and I think now she knows better. I owe everything to her, and I'm blessed to have somebody who is as supportive perseverant in putting up with my anxious foibles as she is, and you know, I wish anyone who has anxiety to be as fortunate to have someone like that. She got far more than she deserved, or far less than she deserved, I don't know how you put it, in being attached to me. And people have asked her, like, what do you get out of this? And she says, well, sometimes he's kind of funny. I that seems like small consolation, but.
And we trust that your two children, who you talk about in the book as displaying some anxiety issues of their own, we trust that they're doing okay, and that you, of course, hope for them to have new and better tools to deal with this.
Definitely, and one thing that my wife has become a champion of is, you know, part sort of campaigning against the stigma of mental illness, precisely so that people who have kids like ours who, you know, have inherited or learned my anxious traits from me can get help. And, you know, the joke in our family is, you know, both our kids have been, they're 11 and 8 now, you know, done short courses of psychotherapy. And my daughter, who developed weirdly some of the same phobias that I did at exactly the same age I had been when she was 6 and in first grade, she still struggles a little bit with it. But the joke in the family is that, you know, she at age 11 is much better than I ever was, and than I am now at age 45. So there's hope and help, and nipping it in the bud early is very, very important.
The book again is My Age of Anxiety: Fear, Hope, Dread, and the Search for Peace of Mind, a best-selling book now available in paperback from Vintage Books, a division of Random House. Scott Stoffel, thank you so much for this marvelous book and for the beautifully crafted book that you've shared with the public. I know it will be of immense help to many, many people. I hope it was a help to you in writing it, and I'm so glad we got to talk about it today. Best wishes to you and your family.
Thanks so much for having me on. I appreciate it.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, I am very pleased to be able to welcome into our studios South African author and entrepreneur Herman Mashaba, who is a special guest of the Carthage campus of the Clausen Center for Political Economy. On Wednesday, deeply honored to welcome into our studios Ray Cross, the current president of the University of Wisconsin System, to talk about the UW's rich history and legacy, and of course about the looming budget cuts with which it will very likely have to contend. On Thursday, contralto Meredith Alwadi, who has sung lead roles at the Lyric Opera of Chicago and the Metropolitan Opera, singing an opera concert this Sunday afternoon at First United Methodist Church as part of their Fine Arts at First series. Support for WGTD's Morning Show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional Morning Show co-host. Cloudy and seasonal today, with skies becoming eventually partly sunny, with a high of 27 degrees. Cloudy tonight, but dropping all the way down to 14 for an overnight low. Tomorrow should be partly sunny. We will warm up to 29 degrees. Wednesday's high should be 33, and then we get much colder. This is WGTD